Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Week, we have a conversation with the legendary Michael Holding. If you don't know who Michael Holding is, get to know. He is a former West Indies bowler, and he was a TV commentator working with Sky to comment on cricket and the like. He announced his retirement in September 2021, so this year. We recorded this episode back in May when he released his book, Why We Kneel, How We Rise. And it is a book that is a densely researched piece of conversation around race, racial discrimination in sport. And he has these conversations with very elite athletes, such as Usain Bolt, Naomi Osaka, Thierry Henry, Michael Johnson. But in this conversation, we discuss when in July 2020, when he was on Sky Sports, he was commenting very, very openly around the lies we are told around race. And in the wake of the George Floyd killing, we had a lot of discussions around race with a lot of public commentators, people that you probably wouldn't necessarily expect to be discussing race. And Michael Holding took to the microphone, and he had a really empowered account of his experiences with racial education growing up in Jamaica, and his experiences of racism throughout his career as a cricketer. So in this conversation, we unpack what it means to be black, his own perspective growing up in Jamaica, but we also had a conversation about how he related to his father, the little discriminations that he experienced growing up in Jamaica. We talk about mental health, what his perspectives are on mental health, and we also talk about vulnerability. So in the book, he speaks to Thierry Henry, like I mentioned, but Thierry Henry writes in the book that he never felt that he was allowed or permitted to cry as a black man. And in the times when Thierry Henry was playing football, and the times when Michael Holding was playing cricket, these weren't times where you could take to social media and express how you felt about, you know, an experience from the crowd to you, or you know, subsequent racial attacks or abuse, or the way that we see footballers and athletes speak about their mental health and their experiences with racism today. There was this idea around resilience, and you know, if you've been following me for a while, you'll know how I feel about resilience. But I believe that resilience, there's not much use for resilience in the way that we use it. We use it as if it's an antidote to emotional hardship. We use resilience as a way to dismiss experiences. We say you should be more resilient, you have to be more resilient, you have to be stronger. And that's the implication. The implication is that we have to be stronger, we have to be tougher, we have to ignore and let things slide off our back. But what resilience does, it doesn't help society change. It's saying that we should adapt to the culture, to society, to all of that. And society shouldn't adapt to the changing nature of people. And people change. And over these generations, over these decades, things have changed. Football has changed. Cricket has changed. The way that we experience these mini and emotional ruptures when it comes to racism, when it comes to discrimination, when it comes to these sorts of pain, things have changed. So in this conversation with Michael Holding, which I was honored to have, it felt as if I was speaking to an uncle, a grandparent. He is definitely an elder. And when I think of elders, I think of elders as having the wisdom and the intuition to be able to hold the fears and anxieties of young people in their hands and tell us things are going to be okay. Show us things are going to be okay. Things aren't necessarily going to be easy. No, that's not what I'm saying. But that things are going to be okay. That the experiences that we go through are valid. That with each generation, we have to move with a new perspective, a new sense of growth, a new idea. Because humans and people change. Ideas change. Attitudes change. I think that we have become so used to things staying the same that we fear this idea of change. So, dialing into Michael Holding when he was in the Grand Cayman, while everybody else was stuck in miserable UK rain in April, May, it was refreshing to hear him speak about his experiences, speak about how he grew up, speak about where he was coming from with all of this. So I'm hoping that you get just a morsel of the feeling that I had in speaking to a man who has been through so much and come out on the other end with so much peace, so much understanding, so much wisdom. And this Black History Month, on the show, I'm going to be speaking to quite a few people who have so many different perspectives and ideas around Blackness and mental health and vulnerability and different ideas around what that looks like. So I'm looking forward to delving in and sharing those conversations with you. So as ever, I invite you to rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast on wherever you listen to the podcast. Apple Podcast is where the reviews tend to live. So if you go there, please. But please, you know, follow it when we want to bump the episodes and the show up. We want to get it into as many ears and phones and computer screens as possible. We want to make sure that you all are hearing and sharing and doing that. And it just helps the show grow, and I would appreciate it. I'd appreciate it if you could just share and rate as you go and share it with people that you think would be interested in the episode as well. And even if they aren't, just slide it into their DMs. You know, use the podcast episodes as a way of shooting your shot, guys. Come on now, you need to be using it. Like, hey, it's time to talk. How about, you know, you listen to this and we discuss it over wine and other things. You know, herbal tea, coffees, wholesomeness. But yeah, guys, thanks so much for being here. I look forward to hearing what you think about the show. And this is my conversation with Michael Holding. Welcome, Michael. Michael Holding, welcome to Time to Talk. How are you doing?
Thank you very much, Ali.
How are you doing?
I am good. I'm very good, as a matter of fact. I'm not yet in the UK. As you know, the test series doesn't start until early June. So I'm still back in the Caribbean, but heading there shortly.
Yes. Can you just tell the people exactly where you are? Because I find it offensive that I have to sit in this country that doesn't understand, that doesn't know whether it's coming or going. The sun doesn't know what to do with itself. It's been raining crazily. And you seem to be in somewhere just, you know, very calm and relaxed. I just don't get it.
I'm pretty much close to paradise right now in so many respects. One, the weather. Yeah. I am in Grand Cayman. The weather is great. It's getting a little bit hot now because we're heading towards summer, as you would realize. But the best thing about it all is that I don't have to worry about anything to do with the virus that's hitting the world right now. We haven't had any cases in Grand Cayman for months upon months, and there are no restrictions. We don't wear masks unless we're going to a doctor's office or into a hospital. We don't have restrictions on restaurants or bars or gathering in numbers. They are putting a restriction of 500, no more than 500 together, wow. Which doesn't really mean a lot. But it's very comfortable, you know, it's great. But don't worry, Alex, summer is coming to the UK as well, and it will soon warm up and be pretty good weather.
Well, it needs to come soon, because we've had April and we never had any showers, and now we're getting all the showers in May, and I'm just thinking something's off. I would like to be in the sunshine. So yeah,
the world weather is a little bit mixed up at the moment. You're getting some awkward weather in different parts of the world.
I'll give the world that last year wasn't really her year, you know, like, so, you know, the world is trying to reconnect back to everything and trying to get it back to normal. Thank you for joining me on the show today. You know, apart from being like a champion cricketer and just an all-round upstanding guy, I'm here speaking to you about your book, Why We Kneel, How We Rise. And, you know, it's a collection of stories around, you know, inspired by the George Floyd murder last year, but also kind of speaking to athletes. You know, we've got athletes in here such as Usain Bolt. We've got, you know, Hope Powell, we've got Naomi Osaka, got Thierry Henry, and just having these conversations around race and what it means to be a person of color in these sports, black, in these sports. And, you know, when we, in the post Floyd era, I was going to call it, we saw when football came back in the UK, we saw everybody kneeling. It was just it became a commonality to see everybody kneeling. We had, you know, black footballers speaking openly about racism in the sport. We have, you know, like we've been having loads of conversations around different industries in particular, but obviously because sport being the most front facing thing at the minute, because that's on everybody's TV all the time. It unites so many different communities and classes as well. I wanted to kick off the conversation around you and what it was like growing up in Jamaica.
Growing up in Jamaica, it was fantastic. You know, as I said on so many occasions, I didn't experience racism in Jamaica. Mm. By the time I came along and recognized, you know, what it was supposed to be, there wasn't much of that in Jamaica. You know, I was born in 1954. I heard many stories of early days in Jamaica, you know, the racism that took place. And I related one story about a gentleman, Mr. Eben Blake, who lived on the same road that I lived on. But this happened long before I was born. And as I said, just growing up in Jamaica as a youngster, we just had a great deal of fun. I had friends from all different races. I also related a story about a young Chinese friend that we had that had scampered away back home before his parents got back home from work. And we didn't know. I didn't know exactly why, but we just thought he had to get home early because he didn't want his parents to come home and he wasn't in the yard. But later on, I recognized that, you know, his parents didn't want him mixing with us darkies.
Oh, wow. Okay. But, you know,
we didn't grow up feeling that way. We didn't feel that sort of racism and that sort of effect on our lives. We were youngsters running around having good fun. I didn't really experience racism until I left Jamaica the first time. First time as a cricketer, that is. I had traveled before. I traveled as a youngster, been to New York, I'd been down to the Eastern Caribbean, but really experiencing racism didn't come along until I went with the West Indies team to Australia in 75. I was 21 years old by then.
Yeah. That's really interesting what you say about your Chinese friend in Jamaica. Like, I'm always interested in this because obviously my family's Jamaican as well. From the North Montego Bay and down in Clarendon, and it's really interesting sometimes because I remember when I first saw a Chinese Jamaican person, and when I was younger, I just was assuming like, I'm in Jamaica, it's gonna be loads of black people, and loads of then when the first few times I went when I was much younger, and you know the motto is out of many one people, there was still this level of differentiation, and you didn't see that when you were there, but you just kind of thought, oh, that's just the way they carry on. That's just the way they act. But then you hear there's small little prejudices. How did that make you feel?
I didn't feel it. I didn't feel it as a young man growing up. There were always little incidents that took place somewhere along the line. As I mentioned, that friend that I had that was of Chinese origin, but we didn't, really, as youngsters, the rest of us didn't really feel as if, you know, he didn't want to be, he wanted to be with us. His parents obviously didn't want him to be. But there's always going to be the odd case where you find some bit of racism or some racist remark or some racist action by someone. But it was so minimal, it was so unusual that you didn't really come across it on a regular basis, at least in my age group. When I did the interview with Usain Bolt, he was similar. He never came across racism. He came about 3 decades after me. And again, he didn't come across racism. There's a classism, yes. A lot of classism in Jamaica still going on. But the racist part of it, the racism, I didn't come across. My mother experienced it. Her family didn't want her to marry a man that was as black as my father. So she experienced it. But again, it went back many years before I came along.
I think the whole colorism conversation is something that needs to be had, especially among Jamaicans. I don't think that we kind of have that conversation a lot. I guess that is a generational thing, I suppose. You know, how are you?
The thing with Latin Alex is not just in Jamaica. We have been brainwashed as a people to believe that the lighter your skin, the better off you are. And that's going to take a long time for it to leave society in general. The skin lightening cream that is sold all over the world is a $1 billion business because people believe what they are being told. And they see it around them that the lighter skinned people, the white people and lighter skinned people get ahead better than they do because those people have less hurdles to jump. But eventually, with the education, which is what I'm trying to do with this book, with proper education, people recognize that that is rubbish. They don't need to be thinking in that way. And hopefully we'll get there one day.
Yeah. How was it writing the book? How did you find writing it?
Some parts of it were difficult. Some chapters were very hard to write, and even to go and read them back. You know, I didn't really want to be reading them too much, too often. You know, as you do a book and you send it to the publisher, it comes back different edits and you have to go through it again. Some chapters, I didn't want to go through them again. When I wrote a couple of chapters about the dehumanization of black people, I, I sent them to my sister. As a matter of fact, in the early days, I sent every chapter that I did to her, for her to, one of my two sisters, that is, for her to go through and to have a look and see what she thought. And a couple of chapters I sent to her, she said, no, I'm not going to read this. It's too difficult. It's too hard to read. You know, my sisters are 80 and 78. So they would know about racism a lot more than me. And they don't want to remind me.
So are you the youngest?
Yeah, I'm the youngest in the family.
Okay. So are you the most outspoken?
Well, I suppose you could say that. You know, my father hardly ever said anything unless he was at work. When he was a builder and contractor. When he was on his building site, he would say a few things. Apart from that, very quiet. My mother, being a teacher, of course, was a lot more outgoing.
Okay. That being said, though, because I know on this show we speak a lot about mental health and mental well-being. Yeah. And I wanted to kind of look at just in three parts, just looking at how kind of your mental health was kind of challenged in those kind of areas of your life. So if we start with like growing up, you know, you said your father didn't really speak much. How did that kind of dictate how you felt about him, but how you felt about being a man as well? You know, we're conditioned really to not talk. And not necessarily have these conversations. Or I know in your book, when you spoke to Thierry Henry and he said, you know, black men aren't supposed to cry. That's something that you know, black men aren't supposed to do. And that really kind of stuck with me, because that's kind of the stuff that I kind of look at and I work on emotionality when it comes to men and how we express and what that looks like with vulnerability. And, you know, and one of the reasons I was so keen to speak to you is because of when you're on Sky and, you know, and you're tearing up and you're crying and upset and, you know, and actually, you know, seeing that, knowing that it's okay for that to happen because you have feelings, you know. What was that like, and what did you learn from your dad in that respect? And how did that kind of, you know, guide you through your cricket career and all of that stuff and becoming a dad yourself?
Alex, I don't worry about preconceived ideas about people, whether they are about their sex or their race or their religion. I don't worry about things like that. I have emotions. I express my emotions under various circumstances and various conditions the way my emotions say they should be expressed. When you talk about theory saying he was taught, or the theory is black men aren't supposed to cry because they are perceived then as weak. I don't care. I cried on a cricket field when I was 21 years old in Australia. And I didn't just go and hide my face to cry. If I feel like crying, I cry. I don't try and suppress my emotions. I don't worry about what other people think. I worry about me and how I express myself. And, you know, that is fine with me, you know. People have had mental issues because they can't handle what they are supposed to do, what they are thought of as supposed to be the way they are. I am not supposed to be anywhere or any way. I am me. So I don't allow those issues to interfere with my life. And perhaps that's the reason why I don't think I've had any mental issues or any stress issues and that sort of a thing. I know my mother, later on in life, I found this out. I know that my mother had to take a pill every day. I shouldn't say her life, because I don't know about her youth. But I know when she was married to my dad and we're coming up as a family, my sisters told me much later on. I don't think I knew until she had died, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
And she didn't die until 2001.
Okay.
So she was under pressure, perhaps because of the fact of her family and her being ostracized from her family. I don't know. I would hate to believe that is the reason. I would believe that it is something a little bit more genetic than that. But she lived her life, in my eyes, enjoying her life. But at the same time, I found out about the fact that she was under stress and was taking a pill every day. to try and calm ourselves. And I don't know the issues, but I didn't have those issues. Mm.
Mm. And how did you later think of your dad then?
Well, my dad is my dad. That's the way he is. When he's honest at work, he's very expressive. And he uses some languages that I wouldn't try to use here, you know, because he's at his work and he's serious about his work. The rest of the time, he's very calm, he's very cool, he's very collected. You know, when things are happening at home, around the dining table, you know, my mother is a person who is more vociferous and talking about various things. And he's just there calm, taking things in. That's just him.
Okay.
I should say that was just him.
That was just him. Yeah. Yeah. But sometimes I think that we kind of, in some ways, we model the closest representation to ourselves, especially when we're in the home, you know? So sometimes I look at, and the conversations I've been having, a lot of guys, they modeled a lot of what their dads did. Until obviously they took a step aside and thought, you know, actually that doesn't work for me. I need to kind of just do what I want to do. It's like literally what you've just said, like you didn't really care. You just kind of did what you did and had always did the way you had to do. So it's always interesting to see kind of where people kind of navigate that kind of understanding of who they are through the mirror of someone else.
Well, when I was a young man growing up, I was very shy. I didn't say a lot either. And that is why when I was approached from the very first time to do radio commentary, I thought the person approaching me, although it was a good friend, was mad. You know, that's not me.
Yeah.
But as time goes on, you know, you mature and you change your in some ways. Even as time went on and I changed and became a bit more outspoken, I wouldn't volunteer opinions. If I'm asked, fine. I'll give you my opinion.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I just kept things to myself. And that's why, even when I spoke out on Skype last summer, a lot of people were shocked.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my friends in Newmarket, when I went back to Newmarket, they were saying, oh, Mike, I didn't know you had those thoughts and you didn't know you. Look, I was never asked. I don't express myself unless I'm asked.
Mm-hmm. That kind of speak unless you're spoken to kind of.
Exactly.
Just gotta go and just crack on with what you gotta do. Where were you when George Floyd was murdered?
Right here in Grand Cayman, last year, May. Just a year ago now, as a matter of fact. Almost a year.
Yeah. How did that affect you?
To be honest, it's something that I grew accustomed to seeing in America. It was shocking to actually see it and to watch it for so long, and especially to see the smirk on Chauvin's face. That really irritated me. But it's something that I see in America. I lived in America for quite a few years. I saw it on the news on a regular basis, on the news regularly. Not as graphically as that, because until recently, people weren't filming these murders. Then people didn't have cameras on the phone to be able to catch it like that. Mm-hmm. As so many people have said, the murders in America have not gone up. It's just that they are now being filmed.
Mm-hmm.
And people are much more aware of them because they are being filmed. So it was not a huge shock to me. I found it disgusting. I found it something that should just unbelievable. But it was not a surprise.
Yeah. So it not being a surprise to you and kind of like, and the like, you know, why do you think it was so impactful though this time around? I grew up and I don't know, when I was growing up, I don't really remember any of these things, but when I was, 21, that is when Trayvon Martin was killed and then Mike Brown and then Eric Garner. And then Sheku Bayo, and then all those guys. I was around 21. I have no recollection of hearing anything about police brutality, black men being killed by the police prior to that. No recollection. No word of a lie. So why do you think the George Floyd murder was so impactful when it happened?
Perfect storm, Alex. The pandemic was on, people were not at work, people could hit the streets. They had no obligations of saying, oh, I have to go to work. They could hit the streets. And everybody hit the streets all over the world to show their displeasure. You have had these demonstrations previously about murders in America. But with people having their commitments, people having their jobs, they would demonstrate for a day or two or in the night after work, and they knew they had to be in their offices or had to go back to work next day. With this one, people were on the streets every day because they were not losing their jobs. And of course, with this one, we did not just have people of color on the streets. We had people supporting the people of color, people from other, as Thierry Henry would say, people from others who saw our community hurting, deciding, no, this is rubbish, and we're going to support these people. And if you look at the faces out on the streets, way back when in the Martin Luther King days, 95% of the people demonstrating were Black or people of color. This time around, you could say up to 45% of the people weren't white. So that's a huge difference. The amount of time available to people to go onto the streets regularly every day and the support from other communities. Mm.
Mm. Super important. I think that was kind of, that was a telling moment. I wanted to go, but you know, I'm still feeling a bit anxious about the whole pandemic thing at the time. And obviously to protection of family, I was a bit like, okay, let me just stay in and kind of do my bit through the show and through my own personal writing. But it became it was challenging to see, because it was like, okay, so now like we are really kind of like shaking the foundations of this white supremacist understanding of what it means to kind of be alive today and in the West. That kind of fear when you step out of the house and you don't feel like you can get to the end safely. You don't know what's going to happen. You could be stopped. Somebody could decide that today is the day that they are going to, you know, attack you or put a halt to you just kind of progressing and processing. And a lot came up in those in those riots and those conversations and the videos and the consistent socials and the consistent conversations around racism that is happening, that people still blanketly try to deny. And I would love to hear what you think about the race report that the UK put out to say that there is.
I haven't read it.
You haven't got it.
I haven't read it. I don't think I'll ever read it.
You know,
I understand it's 200 pages or something like that.
I've got other novels to read.
The conclusion that they came to, I think everybody around the world knows that those conclusions are ridiculous.
Yeah.
It might have some good things within the meat of it all, but once you come to that conclusion, no, sorry.
It's frustrating because we're saying one thing and then they've rallied together a group of people to come to tell the nation that we're lying, or we're making a fuss out of nothing, or all of that. And I kind of wanted to ask, because I know that in my career as a journalist, there was definitely institutional racism. There was definitely a particular kind of story that they would run with. There were typically ideas that were long held that they really upheld with regards to the stories that they were running, and that I had no kind of option other than to risk career suicide in places. But also I had to think about my community at the same time. So there were things I had to say no to just on principle. What was it like for you coming up? you know, the 70s cricketer. And I want to actually, I want to know why you're called the Whispering Death, but we're going to get to there. You know, we get there in a moment. But racism in cricket. I know you said that when you were playing, you never necessarily heard much racism, but what was it like?
Not at all. Like, I never had a racist comment made to me if I'm in a cricketer.
Okay.
If a racist comment was made in my direction, they would have been a long way away from me and I wouldn't have heard it. So I can genuinely say I never got any racist remarks thrown at me from a fellow cricketer. You hear it in the stands. On the other occasion on the road or in different circumstances away from the game, people do things or say things that you know that's just them being racist. But as I said in the book, when I was playing cricket, I lived in Jamaica. I spent perhaps 3.5-4 months in these countries where I would come across racism. And I just basically said to myself, these people have a problem. I am not going to worry myself about them. I'm somewhere back home in Jamaica. I'll be rid of them. So I just brush it off. Water off a duck's back.
Yeah.
So I had no problems. I had no issues where that was concerned. Whenever you came across any bit of racism, sometimes it can make you feel a little bit of a lesser person. Mm-hmm. But again, I just brush it off. I don't have to live this life. That's what I kept on telling myself. I'll soon be home. So no problem.
Didn't that feel kind of heavy for you though? In a sense. No. As soon as you get back onto the thing, people have these views about you.
No. It was not heavy for me at all. It was not as comfortable as you would want it to be. You know, you go into these countries. And you know you're going to come across some idiots. A few, again, I want to stress, more times than not, the tours were enjoyable. And you come across some great people. I've made some great friends all over the world, all different races and creeds and colors. But you're always going to come across some idiots somewhere along the line. And they're going to do something or say something. But again, because it's minimal, you can afford to ignore it and move on. You see, as all my time coming up, if no one actually physically touched me, I could ignore them. I could move on. If somebody would know what to do, something other than to pass words or to just do something racist, that might have been a slightly different situation because as a young man growing up, I was a little bit fiery. But I could ignore remarks and looks and faces. I could do that because, as I said, I knew I was going home. I didn't grow up in it. If I grew up in the UK, as a matter of fact, I've told people, if I went through what Ebony Rainford Brent went through, there's no way I would have finished my career. I would, no way I would have played test cricket for 12 years. No way I would have gotten to the stage in life that I am now being on television because I would not have put up with it and I would have done something that I perhaps should not have done.
How did you move from being a shy boy to a fiery man? What was that transition like?
Well, I don't think I'm fiery. You know, being a fast bowler, you have got to be aggressive being a fast bowler. But even so, even when I was playing, I never really said a lot. I went out and I did my job. I bowl fast. If I had to bowl a bounce or two, I bowl a bounce or two. You never see any film, you'll never go back and see any film of me saying anything to a cricketer on a cricket field or anything like that, and all this mouthing that you see going on now. You never see anything like that from me. I kept all that within myself. So I was still being looked upon as somebody who didn't speak a lot, who was still reasonably shy, even throughout my cricket career. When I was amongst my friends and my family, sure, I would talk, I would be a little bit more outgoing, but away from that, I was still quite calm, collected. And even now, I don't think people would say that I'm fiery. I express an opinion. If you ask my opinion, I'm going to tell you what my opinion is. Mm. But that's what you should do as a human being.
Yeah, it's what you should do as a human being, to be fair. Kind of keep your opinion to yourself. Is that what you're saying?
No, no, no. You express an opinion if you're asked. That is what I do. You know, in my job, I'm not a person who sits on the fence when I'm working for Sky. I express my opinion. I give my opinion as to what is happening on the cricket field and to what is happening with various cricketers or whatever like that. That's just the way I am. I am going to tell you because that's my job. And if you ask me anything that even if it's controversial, I'm going to respond. I'm going to answer.
Yeah. So when it came to, I know because a big part of what you say is about our racial education and what we learn about race growing up and what that means for us. When did you learn about the man who built the filament in the light bulb and other key people of interest who were black? Because as you said, you know, you grew up, you didn't really hear much of that. You said that you spent a long time in secondary school, but you didn't get any of that kind of education. But when did you start picking up all of these kind of new things and start seeing that, oh wow, like there are more black people who are influential than I thought and believed?
It was not until I stopped playing cricket.
Until you stopped?
And I started.
Okay.
Yeah, after I retired, I didn't know about a lot of what I know. No, I didn't know when I was actually playing the game. I started to read a lot more. When I was playing cricket, when I was touring with the West Indies, I read, but I would read Louis L'Amour cowboy books and, you know, that sort of thing, and novels and that sort of a thing. As I started to travel more as a cricket commentator and spend a lot more time in hotels on my own or on airplanes, I started to read other books, other more informative books. And that's where you learn a lot more about what took place many, many years ago, or get more knowledge even about what's happening now. And that is when I started to learn these things. I won't be able to tell you exactly when I learned specific things, apart from what I have learned now from doing the research for this book that I am doing. A lot of stuff in that book I didn't know before. Mm. But doing the research for this book, I learned a lot more. But my learning and my real gathering of information didn't start until I retired from playing international. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So what is one of the key things that you learned?
You mean about history?
What was one of the things that is the key thing? Because I always think to myself, like, I know for me, the turning point for me was when I read Malcolm X's autobiography. And I started thinking a lot about myself and my own consciousness as a black man. I was studying in Europe at the time. So my blackness was very, very pronounced wherever I was. In France and Spain. So when I read Malcolm X and I watched the Denzel film, then I watched a documentary of his life, then I read parts of his autobiography again. So I wanted to get clear on what I was seeing and what I was hearing. And that was a key part of my education, because I was like, okay, so this is what he stood for. This is his journey. This is the journey of him. Of a man that has kind of like moved through particular things. This is what he stood for politically. This is what he stood for in his family. This is what he stood for in his community. And it made me learn a bit more, made me open up my mind just that little bit more to kind of really understand who I was in this space and in this context. And I really want to know, like, what was the person? I know there's so much that you consumed and you looked at, but what was the one that you thought, wow, I wish I'd known about this man or this woman before, or this person inspired me?
Alex, what I find is people who grow up in communities where they are a minority, they are more apt to look for an identity I didn't grow up in a community where I was a minority. So I was looking for an identity. So it wasn't as if I was looking to see what other person like me can I read about or look at to try and formulate myself. It wasn't like that for me. Growing up in Jamaica, and by the time I got to a sensible age in Jamaica where you're really grasping what's going on and you're seeing the society in which you grow, I think the people in, I think it was what, 97% black by the time I really got into my 20s. So I wasn't looking for an identity. Everybody around me was like me, or the majority, vast majority around me were like me. If I grew up in England, if I grew up in Australia, if I grew up in South Africa under the apartheid regime, and I was looking now to lift myself and looking for an identity, perhaps I would have been looking towards people like that if I had heard about them and looking to try and build my life around them or like them if I had heard about them. But I didn't really have that as a young man growing up. As I said, later on in life, when I started to read a lot more about these iconic people, you get to learn. But I wasn't seeking it, because I didn't think I had to seek it, because I didn't feel uncomfortable in the environment in which I was.
Yeah. I hear that. So there's a particular context of what it means, depending on where you're from in that real, when you, because
it makes a difference. Yeah. The community in which you're growing up and the country in which you're growing up.
For sure. What is more?
If Malcolm X had grown up in Jamaica, he wouldn't be the person that he was, because he wouldn't need to be fighting against any oppression or fighting against anything.
You say that.
It's a different situation depending on where you are.
Say that, and then Garvey grew up in Jamaica.
No, Garvey went to America.
But didn't he have the ideas before he went to?
Yes, because when he was a young man in Jamaica, Jamaica hadn't gotten independence yet. They were still ruled by the British. And then he left and went to America. And again,
the struggle.
Minority.
Yeah.
By looking for an identity, looking to try and uplift his people. If Marcus Garvey had grown up after independence in Jamaica, he would still have the same thoughts, but he certainly would not have to be as radical as he was and looking to force himself on issues.
That's interesting. I always think about how we show up in those spaces, because I have to sometimes think like, all right, so is it something that everybody should learn at the same level, or is it something that is only very specific to specific people depending on where they grew up? So for example, me growing up in London in the 90s and early 2000s, should we have the same level of Black history understanding as people from the Caribbean and or West Africa or East Africa should have with regards to their own, with regards to Black history and understanding what that means? Like, what does that look like then? Do you know what I mean?
I know what you're talking about. You see, if we're going to solve this problem of racism, mm-hmm. we have to make sure that what is taught is even-handed. It's not, the curriculum can't suit one race. The curriculum has to be one where everyone understands the true history. So if we can get rid of the thought, because it's a false narrative that they have been pushing for centuries, get rid of that thought of white superiority and white supremacy. Because what causes that is the teaching, the brainwashing that has been taking place. When you teach one slant of history, when you hide all the great things that people of color have done, so that people of color growing up don't have idols and don't have role models to look up to and to aspire towards, that is what causes the problem. And that is why we need to educate and to re-educate, because a lot of what we have been taught were lies. and a lot of the brainwashing that has taken place, it's going to be hard to get rid of until we can open people's eyes so that them see that it was brainwashing, that it was not what we were taught. If you keep on repeating a lie over and over and over, people eventually will think it's the truth. And that is what has taken place over a very long period of time. So until we can clear people's heads, black and white, of all this brainwashing, and to educate them properly for them to understand exactly what the true history is, we're going to struggle. And if you're a minority in a society, it is more difficult because that society is going to be less apt to change. Are people willing to look at the right thing, to open their eyes and see the light and say, yes, this is the way it is. This is not what we have been taught is not true. This is the way it is, and this is what we need to do now to fix it.
Yeah.
Are people willing? You know, you have a lot of people that have a very nice, cushy, comfortable life, and they're not interested in anything else. They are just interested in the life that they are living. Nothing worries them. That even when they see all the demonstrations and all the abuse, they're not worried. It doesn't affect them. But we need people that, whether it affects them or not, to look and to just be human. Show a bit of humanity, a bit of empathy for what is going on around them. And that is what we need to make change.
Yeah. How do we show empathy and humanity? How do we do that? I think that...
Well, we can only hope that people will, when they are re-educated, will learn how to do that. You can't force people to do things, but if you re-educate them and show them what the world really is, perhaps then they can say, yeah, we know this is what we need to do.
Yeah.
If you can show a person a reason to change, or show a person to... The facts to show them what they were taught is not correct, why should they change?
What did you think about the kneeling in the UK? A lot of people were confused by that.
They are confused. I'm not too sure why anyone should be confused. The thing is, if you take a knee, mm-hmm. I think that is just the accepted gesture to support Black Lives Matter. Where anywhere in the world, as we have seen, I've seen a Swedish women football team, all white, take a knee before the start of a game. It's just an accepted gesture. I support this movement. I'm showing my support for the movement. I can also understand, Alex, what I've heard, some of the stories I've heard about some black footballers who are fed up and say, what's the point of taking a knee and nothing else happens? I can sympathize with them where that is concerned. Because if that is all that you're doing, if all you're doing is ticking a box by taking a knee and say, oh yes, I've taken the knee, what's the point?
Yeah.
You need action after that. And that is what they are saying. Let us see some action apart from just us taking a knee.
Mm.
I wouldn't stop taking a knee. But I can understand and sympathize with their feelings about continuously taking a knee and seeing nothing happening.
And that is the thing, because it's like, when I started seeing, I was like, oh yeah, this is nice. This is a good statement that we're making here. Like, and you know, to see the football clubs, you know, saying like, yeah, this is what we're doing. This is what we're focusing on now. Going forward, I was like, okay, but then also I was just like, well, what actually happens next? Because I'm always concerned about what happens next. Like, yeah. I'm okay. I'm good to understand the present. I'm good to understand the present, and I know where we are coming from. There are things that we need to relearn and kind of understand about what's come or what's brought us this far. The present is the present. We're here. What are we doing next?
Well. Everybody says, what do you do next? I don't think it's a matter of next. I think the taking a knee can happen at the same time as other actions that need to take place. I don't think it's take a knee and then stop and then other things happen afterwards. You continue to take a knee while the actions that are required are taking, are taken. And the actions that are required are reasonably simple. People to understand that what is happening is wrong. And people to understand that you need change and not just talk about change. Let us see some real action. I have seen action in the United States that has gone way beyond anything that has taken place in the United Kingdom, which surprised me a bit.
Yes.
I have read and seen huge corporations in the United States put up millions of dollars to support initiatives and programs to try to level the playing field. What have I seen or what have we heard of in the United Kingdom? I haven't seen anything. I haven't heard anything. I haven't heard any corporations or any big companies coming out and saying, this is what we are doing. The only company is Sky. I know that I put millions of dollars towards anything at all. I haven't heard anything else. The government, they are trying their best to say everything is rosy. There's not a problem anywhere in the world. You don't need to even look at the curriculum. You hear the prime minister saying we can't go back and edit history. History has already been edited. Yeah. We need the full teaching, not part of it. But that just shows you the attitude of the government and this current prime minister. So I'm not too sure how far we're going to get as far as the administrative aspect of it is concerned. But apart from that, let us see corporations and big companies coming out and forcefully doing things. Don't be afraid. There was a department store, I understand, at Christmas who had an ad with a black couple.
Tesco. Was it Tesco?
And they were slaughtered.
Sainsbury's, I think it was.
Sainsbury's, was it? They were slaughtered. There was an ITV program, a quiz program that had three black couples. They were slaughtered. Ofcom got thousands of complaints. These companies need to stand up and say, okay, you don't like it, we're going to give you more of it.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid, because that is the direction in which you need to move.
Mm-hmm.
We need equality. We can't afford for a few racist people to come out and change any positive action that is taking place. And I don't see that much happening in the UK. I see a lot happening in the US. And I'm a little bit disappointed with the UK.
Yeah. I think a lot of what happens here is quite behind the scenes. Like with regards, like with regards to what you said about the advert, they just continued to put more in front of people. They didn't necessarily say anything explicitly. They didn't say, we stand here, this is what we do. They basically just said, okay, well, you guys are complaining, well, here's more. And then all of the all of the shows and all of the TV stations started to do that. Like, you know, there was a issue with one of the supermarkets that didn't that cut somebody out, that cut a black woman out of the ad because they didn't want to bring that. And then that was something else as well, because then it was short-sighted, it was misguided, it wasn't great for their brand at all. So, you know, I think what I do understand is that when it comes to America, a lot of the time when it comes to these corporations, from what I gather, what I've seen, is that when the bottom line is money, there is a sort of willingness to take on the social cause. If it means that money is no longer being made, then there is a sort of like a, oh, okay, well, let's take this stance and let's do it. Sometimes that can end up being very misguided as well. And I think that sometimes over here, it just becomes, it's like, well, this is the status quo. This is what it's like. This is what it's always been like. We're not going to change that idea and that opinion. And it does mess with your mental a lot, because you're just actually just like, you're like, well, what does it take for me as a young black man in this country, as, you know, black women and just black people here, to have people in their corner, in their behind them, to support them, to feel supported, to have that sort of, understanding of who we are and why we do the things we do, and kind of like, if we are kind of mistreated, then who is there to support us in that? And I think that's a lot of, and these are kind of the questions I feel like a lot of Black people have behind, in the back of their minds. They go out, we exist, we try to exist each and every day in the way that we want to show up in the best way we can. But if we go out and we don't feel supported, we don't feel like we belong, we don't feel connected to the place that we are, what do we do? What do we do next?
Well, that is the problem. The Black people alone cannot change the situation. They have to walk hand in hand with other communities. If Black people alone try to do anything, you ain't gonna get very far. When you are the minority in a country, how can you get very far if you are the only ones trying to make change? If you are the majority, you don't need the support of the minority, but the minority need the support of the majority. Unless people join hand in hand, no real change is going to take place. And the change has to come in the society. That's why I'm saying people have to come together. The society does not change. If people in the society do not accept that change needs to come, it ain't going to come. And once that society accepts it and starts moving towards that change, you don't have to worry about football or cricket or athletics or any sport, because the people from the society is what you'll get attending these sports or playing in these sports, participating in these sports. So it's a matter of the society coming together and saying, yes, let us move hand in hand and let us move towards better.
Okay. Two questions. Just what are some of the highlights of your career that you miss?
I don't miss anything in my career. I enjoyed my career. I had a great time playing for the West Indies. I played with a great team. I had a fantastic success. You know, I look back on my career with a lot of joy, but I don't miss it. You know, you go through different phases in life. I have moved on from that.
What were the highlights?
Well, beating Australia in Australia for the very first time, 1979-80. The first ever West Indies team to beat Australia in Australia. That is definitely my highlight of my career.
Is that where you got your nickname?
No, I've not done that.
Is that where you got your nickname?
No. I got my nickname from Dickie Bird. I don't know exactly when, but Dickie Bird is, I understand who gave me that nickname.
Okay. Do you know why?
When he said that, the whispering was from the fact that I was so quiet on my feet. You know, he didn't hear me when I was running in. And I came from that far back, he had to keep looking to see if I was actually running in. And he said the death was because I bowled fast enough to kill.
Oh, wow. Wow. The whispering death. Thing is that if you were of this generation, you probably would have had that on a t-shirt or something, and you probably would have printed it on a hat.
Not me. People perhaps would have had it on a t-shirt. I
would have printed it on a t-shirt, had that trademarked. You probably would have had them, like,
not me,
in the crowd saying, obviously whispering, they'd have been like, yeah. All right.
If I was of this generation, I would probably have an agent who would have gone about doing that.
Really. I just got some final few questions in just to ask you. So one lesson that you've learned or want to change about the way we have conversations around mental health.
What I would like is for people to understand that it's a serious thing, that it's real. You know, a lot of people think that people are weak when they tell you that they have mental issues. You know, you heard even that in cricket, when certain cricketers came home from tours, and, you know, when you go back to even more recent times, you hear a cricketer say, no, I can't manage this anymore, and he goes home, or he's under pressure, and he just divorces himself from things. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't understand. But what they need to realize is that it is real. And they must have a little bit more sympathy with people who do have these mental issues.
Yeah.
it's almost like the same race thing. A lot of people do not understand racism. But if they took the time to learn, they would then come around. I've had lots of people who have told me that they have come around and they don't understand what's going on. Before, they just lived their lives. They did not need to understand racism. Same thing with mental issues. A lot of people go through their entire life. They have no friends, no families that have had mental issues. So they don't really care too much. They just live their lives. But if you care about mental issues and you start to think and learn and try to read up and understand mental issues, then you'll have more empathy for people who do have mental issues.
For sure. Do you have any daily rituals? Like any things, any routines that you run through on a daily? You just get up in the Grand Cayman and just look at the coast. I'm imagining you live by the coast. I just feel like you just live. I feel like you wake up and this.
Well, I live by a canal.
Ah, see.
I am not far from the sea.
Oh, okay.
That canal comes in from the sea, and the sea is perhaps a half a mile down the road from me. But I have no real. I tell you what, in the mornings, even if I'm not that interested in the racing that's going on in England, I'm not even having a bet, I turn on my computer and I watch racing from the UK. I do a lot of that. That's perhaps the only ritual that I have.
Okay. How do you keep fit? How do you keep active?
I walk.
How far?
I don't walk as much as I used to, but I used to walk almost every day of the week, not weekends, every day of the working week.
Okay. And one thing that, let me ask you this question. What's one song that makes you feel a particular way? So one thing, the song that makes you feel happy.
Makes me feel happy.
Feel joy. Joy is the word.
Yeah, but there are so many songs that I enjoy. There's so much Michael, music
you're gonna
that
have
I
to pick one. You're gonna have to pick one. You're gonna have to pick one. There are so many. That means you must find one.
No, but different music and different songs, you listen to them at different times when you're in different moods.
What was the song?
The atmosphere alone right now.
Okay.
My favorite song right now is War by Bob Marley, which is a speech by His Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie that he gave, and Bob Marley turned it into a song. And if you look at the words, you'll know why, with the atmosphere as it is, why it's my favorite song. Because it's all about until a man's skin is no more significant than the color of his eyes, he's going to have war. He's talking about the racism and the injustices in the world. But again, that's just with the atmosphere that's on at the moment. I wouldn't sit down and listen to that and feel happy and to be joyous about that. But it reminds me about Bob Marley and how far ahead of his time he was. He and Marvin Gaye wrote some music that's unbelievable. And people dance, people listen to it, and people didn't really hear it. Both of them are now dead, and they have left some music that will live forever. And the words of those songs will live forever. But hopefully, in the future, people will recognize that, yes, we have gotten to where these people were talking about. We have gotten to the equal justice and equality in life. But those guys were well ahead of their time.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for joining me on the show today. Super appreciate. So this is your book, Why We Kneel, How We Rise, with loads of contributions from amazing Black athletes, and looking forward to getting people reading that and seeing and picking up the stories from these athletes to get an understanding of their experiences and what it means. I mean, it was super inspiring to read about Usain Bolt and Thierry Henry in particular, because growing up with them, they were never really political figures. They were just, I just remember Thierry Henry saying va va voom on the Renault advert, yes, and that was it. Like, you know what I mean? And it just went quiet after that. You know, so these things are important, and I'm amazed that we can still be having these conversations in the way that we're having them, and even more so that it's in a book. So thank you so much.
An important contribution in that book as well, Alex, is from Jeff Harriot, the headmaster up in Manchester, talking about curriculum and talking about what he learned as a teacher. That's a very important contribution as
Jeff
well.
Harriot. Well, everybody, thank you so much for joining me on the show today, and I'll catch you all.